Hello and welcome to Canary Pod, a podcast from the team behind the Canary. I'm Nancy Mendoza, Director of Communications and Membership. Each week, we bring you a look behind the scenes at the biggest stories of the last 7 days. Today, we're looking at the Israel-Palestine conflict and Brexit, and we've got several quite juicy stories there for you. I've got with me Canary writer Steve Topple and weekend editor Tracy Keeling. Welcome to you both.
Morning. Hello.
Now, the Israeli occupation of Palestine is a topic that is very close to our hearts at the Canary, as listeners will be well aware. First of all, Tracy, tell us about what's been happening at the UN.
Yeah, so it wasn't generally reported too much, but on the 29th of November, it was the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinians. And to mark that occasion, the UN passed a series of resolutions on Palestine and Israel. One of the resolutions was on Israel's occupation of the Golan Heights, which, of course, was seized in 1967 and prior to that was part of Syria. So they passed a resolution for Israel to return that to Syria.
Now that's interesting, isn't it? We had a story a couple of weeks ago about Priti Patel having some unofficial meetings in Palestine. And I think I'm right in saying that one of those included a trip to the Golan Heights, despite the fact that the UK does not recognise the Golan Heights as an Israeli-occupied area. So this couldn't really be more topical.
Yeah, indeed. So you're absolutely right. The UK doesn't recognise Israel's authority over the Golan Heights because it's an occupied area. Priti Patel, prior to her resignation as a minister, she went to a field hospital in the Golan Heights, supposedly. It is very topical for the world in general and for the UK in particular, because there were reprisals for that very thing in terms of Patel's case. But the UK voted against the resolution for Israel to be aware that it should return the Golan Heights to Syria. And that was out of step with what it's done historically, and out of step with what the EU does, with what other European nations, what their stance is.
So which is it? Are we saying Priti Patel should be sacked because she's gone to the Golan Heights despite the fact that we don't recognise it as part of Israel? Or is it that we say that actually Israel shouldn't be told to get out of the Golan Heights? That's hugely contradictory. I mean, I suppose I shouldn't be surprised with the number of U-turns this government has done, but that seems a bit, that seems weird. Why? Yeah. What's going on?
With her leaving the cabinet, that was part and parcel of it, but I'm quite sure the fact that the government was generally unaware of those things happening, supposedly, was part and parcel of why she's no longer in place. But you're absolutely right. Contradictions are not unusual with the government. In fact, there was a glaring, just weird situation on the day of the UK voting against the resolution. So they, by the way, largely said that they were voting against it because they it was proposed by Syria, and they suggested that it was an attempt by Syria to kind of distract from the horrors that are being inflicted on the people in Syria itself. But as part of the argument, the UK representative said to the UN, and I quote, "The duty of the General Assembly is to draw attention to international humanitarian law violations wherever they occur. this resolution risks discrediting that vital responsibility. Huh? So they were saying that on the basis of, you know, we are meant to be condemning the violations in Syria. And so they were saying, well, and this distracts from, you know, Syria's crimes. But the fact that they said wherever they occur, and let's focus on violations, there are numerous that happen in the occupied territories.
Absolutely.
So they disproved their very point by making, you know, within their own statement. So yes, contradictions are rife with it.
And it's not, you know, it's not the best time for that to be happening, really. I mean, there are fresh conflicts bubbling in the area at the moment. I know there have been reports of kind of, you know, threats of action from both sides over the last few weeks, and we know what powder keg that bit of the world is, so it's a pretty worrying time to be having a row about it, really.
Yeah, it is. And prior to that moment, by the way, there was a very unhelpful position that the UK took back in March, which we looked at when we covered that that resolution vote. And in March, apparently, again to the UN, to the Human Rights Council at the UN, the UK apparently threatened to vote against any measures in relation to Israel unless essentially, this is a complete paraphrase, but essentially unless the UN stopped picking on Israel. That was the sense of it. The UK said, you're doing too much, you're taking too much action on Israel, you're, you know, repeatedly bringing resolutions up about what's happening there. Unless you stop that, unless Israel stops being a focus of resolutions, we are not going to vote. We're going to vote against every single one from this point on. So, I mean, that is just nonsense. I mean, talk about an unhelpful or a damaging position to take.
Absolutely.
We'll stop any progress unless you stop looking at the violations you say are within your duty and that we say are within your duty.
It's gross, really, isn't it? I mean, just, you know, for listeners, if you're not familiar with the kind of history of this conflict, then it's well worth having a look, because you could be forgiven for thinking that this has been a kind of tit for tat. You know, they attack us, we attack them. You know, this has been going on for ages. It's a religious conflict. You know, it's an inevitable part of you know, Jews and Muslims trying to live in the same space. It's really not that at all. This is, you know, if you unpick this stuff, actually what's going on is you've got one of the largest military powers in the world in Israel. You've got Palestinians who, for, you know, 70 years now, have been under an illegal occupation, and it's an occupation that is based very much on not a religious conflict, but actually a racial apartheid. So, you know, actually the way that Palestinian people are treated by the Israeli government is, you know, more down to the color of their skin than it is down to their religion. The kind of the divisions along racial lines within Israel itself are pretty shocking. You know, you're basically, if you're not a kind of Western European or North American white Ashkenazi Jew, you're basically a second class citizen, Jewish or not. Don't be fooled into thinking that this is a kind of equal match between, you know, two vicious authorities. It's an ages-long colonial occupation of an area that has been populated by Palestinians, by, you know, Palestinians of all races and faiths for many, many thousands of years. And, you know, this is not a kind of sandpit in the middle of the desert that nobody was using. And, you know, when it came to it in 1948 and, you know, the world decided that there ought to be a Jewish nation, you know, they weren't looking and going, oh, look, that, you know, there's some unoccupied space there. Let's go and develop it. And, you know, let's, use up all the water resources so that we can, you know, make it look a lot more like Bel Air and a lot less like the middle of the desert and, you know, all of that. And it's, you know, it drives me absolutely to distraction, you know, the kind of language and the way that these conversations happen. When, you know, in reality, you've got, you know, 1.8 million people in Gaza who are living in an open prison. They are surrounded by a wall. Their freedom of movement is severely restricted. You can only leave if you've got a work permit, and those are pretty hard to come by. And, you know, there's massive restrictions on what goes in to these occupied territories. The Israeli government have been known to say, well, you know, let's work out the caloric needs of these people, times it by 1.8 million, and, you know, and only let that go in.
I think Noam Chomsky previously has talked about that, saying that it's that calorific count is specifically enough to enable them to survive, but not enough to allow them to thrive.
Exactly.
So it's on a diet. But, exactly. You know, a diet that
those were the words used. We're putting Gaza on a diet. It's just absolutely gross. So when we're talking about, you know, saying that the UN has done too much holding Israel to account, you know, personally, look, I'm Jewish by background. People find it surprising, therefore, that, you know, I am pro a one-state solution. You know, people talk about a two-state solution. We divide this up and some of it belongs to Israel and some of it belongs to Palestine. Well, you know, that's basically what we've got at the moment, and it's not working. That's like saying, you know, let's carve up Johannesburg and give, you know, all the nice neighbourhoods to the white people and all the Bantustans to the black people. And that would be the equivalent if we did that in Palestine. So, you know, I'm very clear that, you know, there is nothing about the racial background of these people, which incidentally is not my racial background. My background is Sephardi, so, you know, I may not be able in Israel to kind of operate at the kind of upper echelons of property ownership and education and all of those things, because actually I don't match up. And, you know, it just, no amount of kind of harking back to what happened in Eastern Europe in the 1930s justifies the way that the Palestinian people are being treated every day by the occupying Israeli government. It's, you know, I just, how anyone in the UK can say to the UN, you're holding Israel to account too much, I just don't get it. It's beyond me. So, yeah. You know, I'm really trying to understand.
Yeah, I think in understanding why, one has to always be aware of the strategic importance of having Israel where it is. Mm. So we have a center of Western power in the middle of the Middle East. Mm. And that surely plays into why we're not dealing with it in the same way we would deal with other countries,
yeah.
Particularly from the US side, of course.
Of course.
They are the country that, much more so than Britain, pumps billions into the defense capabilities of Israel. And that's surely not just to protect the people in Israel, it's to have a strategic position,
yeah,
from which, you know, to do what, you know, what the Western powers consider, you know, what's necessary.
Well, and of course, you know, it's not just the US kind of pumping resources into Israel, it's also, you know, UK arms companies who are selling weapons to Israel, which Israel then use against the Palestinian people. And, you know, the firepower of Israel compared to the firepower of the Hamas government is just, I mean, it is orders of magnitude greater. And you go to these arms fairs and and these weapons are listed as battle tested. And, you know, for battle tested, read, we used this to bomb.
We tried it on the Palestinians.
We used it in 2014 during Operation Protective Edge. We had a go at, you know, dropping these bombs on Gaza, and we know that they work. I mean, that's, you know, that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about Western powers, you know, in every way possible, enabling the destruction of the Palestinian people, because that is what Israel, that's what the Israeli government wants. The Israeli government wants the entire destruction of the Palestinian people. They want to expand the occupied territories, you know, to the point where Palestine just doesn't exist anymore.
I think it's also like so much of the detail about this area is deliberately omitted or glossed over. But we're just talking about the Israel's military capacity. It's also known to have an unknown amount of nuclear weapons, so it's one of the nuclear powers. And it is specifically Israel's nuclear capacity which stops nuclear weapons being banned in the Middle East. Most Middle Eastern states, including Iran, which is the one, you know, the one country that everybody, all the world powers seem to suggest is a rogue, you know, nuclear wanting nation, they are willing to sign up to a non-proliferation Middle Eastern agreement, but it can't happen because Israel wouldn't be allowed its nuclear weapons. So it factors into a lot of international issues.
You just, you know, there's layers and layers and layers of this. It's a hugely complex scenario, and you know, it really is worth sitting down and getting your head around it. This week, Donald Trump has been up to something in relation to Israel, I gather.
He has indeed, So this week, Donald Trump declared that the US is going to recognise Jerusalem as the Israeli capital, and that he's going to start the process of moving the US embassy to Jerusalem.
Goodness me. Now, for listeners, just, you know, that might not sound like a big deal, but just explain why, you know, a move to Jerusalem as the capital and the US embassy moving there is such a big deal.
So we've already mentioned the occupation, and there were, you know, various stages of Israel's expansion in the region. First of all, in 1948, for which the 70th anniversary is coming up next year, known among Israelis as the War of Independence, happened in 1948. It's not known as that by the Palestinians. It's known as the Nakba, the catastrophe. But one of the things that happened in that so-called war is that Israel seized West Jerusalem. And by the way, it was the UN, of course, that partitioned Palestine to create the State of Israel.
That's right.
With, you know, the okay from us, because from the UK, because at that point, when the partition plan was on the cards, the UK governed Palestine. Essentially, it was one of our essential colonies post First World War. So in 1948, Israel, just to track back. So the partition plan, in terms of Jerusalem, it didn't designate it Palestine or Israel. It designated it a special kind of international status, because it's so important in terms of religious significance for everyone, for Muslims, for Jewish people, for Christians. So it was meant to have a special status and not belong to anyone in particular. But in 1948, Israel seized West Jerusalem. And then in 1967, which is when the occupation essentially really started, it occupied East Jerusalem. So it has de facto control over Jerusalem right now, but there are still hundreds of thousands of Palestinians living in that area.
So the idea of saying, you know, Jerusalem should be the capital of Israel is massively, massively controversial. And, you know, Trump has actually made quite a significant statement by saying that the US will recognize Jerusalem and move the US embassy there. Now, you would have thought this was a chance for the UK to intervene and to say, no, you know, Jerusalem has to remain this kind of protected area for all of the reasons that it always has been. That's not quite what happened, though, is it?
No, it isn't. So there was the mild hope that the government might take action in some way, because the words that they used specifically directly after Trump announced the decision suggested that they were, you know, going to take quite a tough line with it. They said it was, a very unhelpful step for the peace process, so-called peace process in the region. But then a debate was called in Parliament. Emily Thornberry raised an urgent question on the issue.
Emily Thornberry is a Labour MP, right?
Yeah, a Labour foreign, a shadow foreign secretary.
Gotcha.
And multiple, and it was a debate, so, you know, many MPs raised concerns. Multiple MPs at the debate, however, said, perhaps this is the very time we should recognise the state of Palestine. This is, you know, something that might be news to people as well, that we don't at this point.
We've said many, many times that we should, but it's never it's never actually happened.
But given that Trump has made this move, which essentially, you know, symbolizes Israel's, you know, priority in that area. If we were to recognize Palestine, it would equalize the, you know, the situation somewhat. So numerous MPs mentioned it, and the government said no. They basically said, yes, we've always said we should recognize Palestine when it's good for the peace process to do so, and then we'll that's our position, that's what we'll continue to do. So there's no there's going to be no recognition of Palestine at this point, which is bizarre, because it's this is the exact moment in, you know, in a time of high tension and this massive imbalance now. It's for the peace process, if it believes in it, this is the exact time it should be done.
But that would have sent quite a strong message to Donald Trump, wouldn't it? I mean, I know Theresa May. I know Theresa May has kind of effectively called him out on that decision. But, you know, just, you know, once again, you know, it's just words. It's a kind of, she's just looking more and more toothless, really. It's, you know, oh, it's just so frustrating.
So we have a invitation to Donald Trump to visit the UK, whether that be a state visit or something more casual. He has been invited to visit the UK. And some MPs suggested that we should take that invitation away, that we should remove it. And that was rejected by the government as well.
Surprise.
Any action that was suggested by the House was rejected. So I should say that the UK has made some effort to get a Security Council meeting organised on the issue, which is happening on the 8th of December, or happened on the 8th of December. So that they have taken that minor action. But in terms of, as a country, what symbolically can we do to, you know, show our opposition to Donald Trump, or to show our support for the actual peace process, none of it was taken up.
So what can we do? There must be something we can do.
Well, you can support the organisations that are supporting and highlighting the situation in the region. So you can, for example, support the Palestine Solidarity Campaign. Mm-hmm. You could also find out more about the Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions Movement.
Okay.
And then you can also, I mean, you should raise your objections with the government.
Yeah.
The more citizens who write to their MPs, who write to Theresa May, suggest, you know, telling them what they believe their representatives should be doing, the more pressure the government will be under to carry it out, to fulfill it.
And we can do that around Trump's invitation as well, of course. Don't underestimate the power of writing to your MP. I mean, it's, you know, those of us who have in the past, you know, we'll all have had the experience of writing on something that is very important to us and we're really passionate about. And, you know, depending on the kind of flavour of your MP, I mean, I know I've unfortunately lived in areas with, you know, capital C Conservative MPs in recent years, and the replies I get are not always very satisfactory. But MPs do respond to volume. It's really important that we don't allow our MPs to stand up in Parliament and say, well, my constituents don't seem to care about this. My constituents are quite happy with how I've been dealing with this issue. No, if you're not happy, you have to tell your MP. It really is worth writing those letters. So, you know, it's easy. Palestine Solidarity Campaign probably has some pro forma letters. It's worth, you know, looking around for that kind of thing. You don't even necessarily have to compose a beautiful, long, you know, involved letter with lots of, you know, history and references. You just literally need to say, look, this thing happened and I'm not okay with it. And, you know, as my representative, I want you to take this side of this story really seriously and make sure that when this comes up in Parliament, you know, this is the side that gets put across, you know, in equal measure.
I would also say, Nancy, that the time is now to do that because many people will be aware that it's the 100-year anniversary of the Balfour Declaration. So there's been quite a lot of publicity and awareness of that.
Can you just explain what the Balfour Declaration is for listeners?
So it was a declaration, a document that was created in 1917, which basically commits the UK to the idea of an Israeli state, of Israel being created. It's named after its namesake, Arthur Balfour.
Yeah. Now that's interesting, isn't it? Because I think a lot of people would think that actually the formation of Israel was only kind of conceived of and thought up at the end of the Second World War when, you know, so many Jews in Europe were killed by, you know, those enacting the policies of the Nazi Party in Germany. But actually, you know, this was conceived an awful lot earlier in time.
Yeah, that anniversary and awareness of that is quite clear in the UK. Mm. It's not so clear that we're also in the year of the anniversary of the 50 years of occupation of Palestine. Mm. It's not clear that next year will be the 70-year anniversary of the battle that we spoke about earlier on in 1948, and that was catastrophic. It's known as the catastrophe for the Palestinians. We're reaching landmarks and huge amounts of time going with no progress being made. I would get on to your representatives now because this is the perfect moment to do so. And we also, of course, have, you know, an incredibly hardline Israeli government. Yeah. Like Nancy, you said you want your generally tend to believe in a one-state solution. Mm. Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, he rejects that. He also essentially rejects the two-state solution. Mm. he was on Andrew Marr talking about it, and he's basically said a Palestinian state needs to look like what Israel and, you know, the rest of the world powers want it to look like. So he, for example, said it has to be demilitarized. Mm-hmm. And a state is not independent if you deny it an army or the right to defend itself. Mm.
So the time is now, folks. You can protest Trump's visit to the UK. You can join the boycott, divestment and sanction movement. And you can take action along with the Palestine Solidarity Campaign. And do write to your MPs and let them know, you know, what your opinion is on this situation, because, you know, this is going to have to be probably the biggest year in a very long time for discussing these issues. Tracy, thank you so much for taking us through that. Right, so we're over to Steve now. Steve, we're going to talk about Brexit, and specifically there's been a bit of an interesting development with David Davis. He's leading the Brexit negotiations for the UK. So this guy is, you know, is basically in charge of making sure that this whole process runs smoothly. Over the last couple of weeks, we've seen sort of farce after farce with this, quite frankly. And you've spotted something which is rather revealing. Tell us about that.
Indeed, yes. So the Brexit roller coaster has been trundling along like the rickety old health and safety hazard it is. And this week, the impact assessments, which everyone's been talking about, have come to the fore again. In a nutshell, what happened was Davis was up in front of the Brexit Commons Committee, and he essentially admitted, I quote, "There's nothing, there's no such systematic impact assessment that I'm aware of," essentially saying that these sectoral analyses, which the government was reportedly doing of the impact on Brexit on various industries across the UK, he's now saying they don't actually exist, which is fascinating. It's fascinating and amusing and kind of damning in equal measure, because when you look back at a potted history of Brexit, if you like, he's made numerous references to these. The one that stands out was an interview on the Andrew Marr show from July, where he specifically said, again, I quote, "I am being very clear about this. In my job, I don't make guesses. You make those decisions based on data. We've got 50, nearly 60 sectoral analyses already done." Now, obviously, everyone jumped on this video because Davis has now come out and said they don't actually exist, but yet he went on primetime BBC One political programming and said they do exist. But the story goes back a bit further than that. You can go right back to December 2016, when he again told the Brexit Committee that, and I quote, "We've carried out or are in the midst of carrying out about 57, I think, sectoral analyses, each of which has implications for individual parts of 85% of the economy." Fast forward to October this year, he told the same committee that Prime Minister May had read the summary outcomes of impact assessments, saying that these analyses went into excruciating detail. Excruciating is probably the best word for Davis's career at the minute. However, fast forward to the 7th of November, he then started to backtrack. Hansard, parliamentary record, says that Davis said in Parliament, "As the government has already made clear, it is not the case that 58 sectoral impact assessments exist." These impact assessments, Nancy, have kind of turned into the holy grail of Brexit, if you like. However, what the government's done with them, they've turned it into the Monty Python version of the holy grail. And David Davis is essentially the Black Knight, if you like, running around going, "It's just a flesh wound, it's just a flesh wound." When actually the whole Brexit process that the government is trying to enact is essentially just falling apart at the seams. So these analyses don't exist. The problem with these is that they underpin the government's whole strategy for Brexit. I mean, it's fairly logical and sort of fairly basic economics and fiscal policy to think that if you were going to remove yourself from a trading bloc and the agreements that come with that, you would think, well, okay, let's maybe have a think about how that would affect our country's industries and our imports and exports, and then maybe think about how we would minimise the effect that would have on that, what policies we need to introduce to protect these industries, to make sure that once we leave the EU, that there's no adverse effect on the profitability of these industries and therefore our GDP. But no, the government doesn't want to do that, and essentially we're pissing in the wind, for want of a better phrase, regarding how Brexit will impact on ultimately the economy. But of course, this sort of underscores the government's live fast, die young approach to Brexit more broadly, really. It's catastrophic from the start. But interestingly, what happened on Friday, the 8th of December, we had an announcement that the first phase of Brexit is complete. Theresa May was up all night, apparently, talking into the wee hours with Mr. Juncker. And we have now successfully completed the first phase of Brexit, whatever that first phase is. I don't know whether it's having a cup of coffee and eating a croissant, whether they've managed to agree and get that done. But apparently we're now able to move on to the second phase of Brexit, which could be a mid-morning snack of maybe a pan au chocolat and a quick espresso. Who knows, a cheeky half pint of Stella maybe as we're in Brussels. However, yes, it just underscores, though, this whole situation with the impact assessments, the chaos surrounding Brexit. I mean, it comes to something when Laura Koonsberg, God love her, herself comes out and basically says that the government is in chaos over Brexit, and she was quite vocal in her back of the hand scathing assessment, if you like, of what's happening.
She's not the only one. I think the Telegraph has come out this week as well and said, look, you know, unless Brexit is delivered now properly, you know, in a way that isn't going to harm the UK, then, you know, May's life as Prime Minister is essentially over already.
No, absolutely. And I think the Telegraph came out and said that on Thursday, which was, its timing was interesting. It was a very knowing article, if you like, that in terms of the fact that May was at the end of this first phase of negotiations. But I feel that the fact that she has passed that hurdle and is down to the second phase, as was announced on Friday, she's now managed to save the last remnants of her skin, if you like, for the time being. It may be a temporary respite, but she has pulled herself slightly back from the brink.
She's pulled herself slightly back from the whole thing by the sounds of things. I think, you know, a few days ago, the Labour MPs in the House were heard shouting, "Where is she? Where is she?" So this is, you know, after all of this Brexit negotiation stuff has, you know, essentially begun to implode, that, you know, she doesn't even turn up for Parliament. I mean, how is this still happening?
It's bizarre, isn't it? I'm not usually lost for words, but I mean, if you were an alien looking down on this planet, seriously, if you were like in the UFO, an alien looking down on this planet, and you sort of honed in on Britain and you saw what the government was doing, you'd get the hell out of here. You wouldn't even consider invading the Earth. I mean, the government's conduct is preposterous, really. It couldn't be more sort of the thick of it if they tried. For all the laughs and for all the sort of merrymaking we can extract from this process, it is actually ridiculous, and the conduct of the government is preposterous and concerning in equal measure. But I think what's more, there's sort of a more concerning aspect in this as well. The news surrounding Brexit is a constant rolling juggernaut of lurching from self-induced crisis to self-induced crisis from the government. And essentially, every one of these crises, which everyone jumps up and down about, is essentially essentially forgotten in a matter of 2 days. And again, it kind of underscores the Brexit process more broadly. They were kind of lurching around, arms frantically waving around, and yet nothing really seems to happen about it, and the government still isn't being held to account. But I think that there's also sort of democratic deficit as well among the public with Brexit. There was an interesting survey by Ipsos Mori done that was published in the Times this week, which divides the UK up into five what they call tribes regarding Brexit. And it's the five groups of people that are talking about Brexit, and there's demographic, there's socioeconomic status, and what their concerns about Brexit are. And four out of five of these tribes that Ipsos Mori called them, the demographic was all middle class, high earning, in fairly well-paid, well-educated roles. Mm. And the category that wasn't classed as middle class was young, urban, sort of lower level professionals, if you like, and graduates. And that, right, for me, that underscores a real problem, that the whole Brexit debate is essentially very much centered around sort of the Twitter echo chamber, the journalists on Twitter who keep pushing the Brexit agenda in debate, if you like. And there's now become a real disconnect between what Brexit actually means and the impact it will have on the population. And a lot of the population, I mean, I know where I live, which is like South London council estate, mm-hmm, no one talks about Brexit. It's never mentioned. That's not the issues people are talking about. The issues people are talking about where I live are the Department for Work and Pensions, the conduct of our local government, our local authority. It's issues with the NHS, it's issues with jobs. No one talks about Brexit. And this Ipsos Mori survey, if you like, I think is quite telling of the debate more broadly. That is, it's essentially a middle class, middle England or metropolitan liberal elite debate that's happening, and there's no connection with a lot of the people in this country. I may be wrong, well, but that's just my feeling.
Presumably a lot of the people who did actually vote for Brexit. I mean, we've been presented with this idea that, you know, many of the people who voted for Brexit are the people who, you know, have been kind of, you know, basically been told, you know, you're being pooed on from a great height. Mm. Well, you know, look at that immigrant over there. That's why. And if you vote for Brexit, then we'll send them back to where they came from.
Yeah, exactly. And now these people are essentially disconnected, if you like, from the process and the debate. But the thing is, Nancy, that the EU referendum was always going to be this conundrum. I wrote for the Common Space, I think, at the beginning of 2016, that wake me up when the damn thing's over, because essentially we were always stuck between a rock and a hard place. You either wish to be shafted by the EU, which is an essentially extremely crony capitalist, corporatist, undemocratic organisation, or you wish to be shafted by the British state, which is essentially a crony capitalist, undemocratic organisation. To coin the Michael Gove phrase, it was ever thus. It was always going to be this. And we're seeing the disconnect that everyone actually has in this process now being meted out. We don't have any control.
Well, you know, that disconnect extends to the House of Commons by the sounds of things. What we're seeing is David Davis over and over again actually denying MPs the information that they need to actually make any decisions about this.
So, Steve, you mentioned that there's been an announcement recently about the first round being done, that something successful has happened. Yay! Is part of that success anything to do with resolving the border issue in Ireland?
I think that's probably there's an element of that in it, if you like. I'm not convinced how much influence that actually had on the process, because it was a massive story, wasn't it? All sorts of dire warnings and doom and gloom regarding the situation and the effect it could have on Ireland. We then had jokes about Arlene Foster essentially actually being the real prime minister, and Theresa May was just standing in for her PMQs. But again, that issue seems to have gone slightly quiet. I think overall we've passed this first phase, if you like, more because Theresa May knew that she was looking so ropey and so on the rocks that she needed to come back with some sort of positive news, if you like, from Brussels. But I think honing in, Nancy, on the point you made previously about how MPs are disconnected as well, I think that's crucial, because I mean, essentially what we've seen, and the SNP called it out, saying that David Davis was in contempt of Parliament, we're essentially seeing the ministers involved in the Brexit process being allowed to allegedly lie, cheat, manipulate the due process and other members of Parliament and get away with it. And you're correct, there's a disconnect even at parliamentary level. And it's beggars belief that we're in the situation. But then when you look at the fact it's a Conservative government who were under the spotlight for election fraud, then maybe it's not quite such a surprise.
Well, and, you know, it seems like at every turn they're saying, well, you know, this will solve the problem, and they're being thwarted. You know, the idea that, you know, they've got this sort of unofficial coalition with the DUP in Northern Ireland to sort of prop up the Conservative minority government. And actually, they couldn't even get that right. You know, the DUP essentially said that if Northern Ireland remains tied to some EU regulations while the UK cuts ties, you know, in order to kind of solve this issue with the UK-Ireland border, then that's kind of, you know, the DUP doesn't like that, because it's basically saying, well, you know, Northern Ireland is going to be something different from the rest of the UK, and they're, you know, obviously very much interested in having Northern Ireland be very much a part of the UK.
Again, I keep using the word staggering, but I can't think of any other adjective which is suitable. It was staggering to watch 10 MPs from a minority party in one of the four nations of the UK essentially hold a gun to the government's head and say, look, you know, this is what we want, and if you don't deliver it, it's game over. I mean, it was staggeringly ironic, considering the fuss that was made about the SNP and the Scotland question, if you like, that all these damned nationalists holding the rest of the country to ransom. But, you know, 10 DUP MPs doing it, well, that's part of the process. It's constitutionally preposterous, and of course that then set off a chain of events, didn't it, where you had Scotland, Wales, London, Walton on the Naze, Clacton, Felixstowe all saying, well, if Northern Ireland can have it, we want access to the single market. So there was a small hamlet in North Somerset probably came out and said
well, I mean, where I live in Bristol, I mean, Bristol's one of the cities that voted Remain overall. You know, we're a transition town, we have our own currency already, and, you know, there's been talk about, you know, do we become sort of annexed to the EU, you know, on our own. And I know, you know, other areas have said the same thing. I don't think it's very likely that will actually happen. But
you don't think Bristol will do a universal declaration of independence?
Well, I suppose, I mean, maybe it will. It will.
Watch
this space, because it's just, I just, as you say, Steve, it is like watching an episode of The Thick of It. You know, the our ability to satirise what's going on now has almost been thwarted by the fact that it already looks like satire.
The reality is far better than any satire writer could possibly dream up.
We don't have Spitting Image anymore. You know, the kind of the TV kind of political satire is not a kind of genre that's very prominent at the moment. And we did actually interview Keith Allen a couple of months ago, actor and broadcaster who's looking to kind of bring satire back in a sort of revival of the kind of late 60s and early 70s satire movement with the reformation of an institution called the Establishment Club, which is where many of our famous satirists kind of cut their teeth. But I wonder how easy it's going to be, really, because maybe it's going to be really easy, because all you've got to do is kind of point and go, look at that, it's ridiculous.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a script waiting for you. I can hear my hamster upstairs now starting work on the first episode of a new series. But I mean, the thing is, Nancy, in all seriousness, what we always say at the Canary and what one of our sort of underlying messages is how can people actually get involved with this, and what can they do to influence this process? And to be honest, it's really hard, isn't it, to say what can we physically now do to influence the Brexit process? I mean, as you were discussing in the previous section, of course, everyone, if this is of concern to them, can be writing to their MPs and applying pressure there. But when you have MPs who are essentially shackled regarding this as well, I think it's going to take some other issues aside from Brexit, if you like, to light a bit of a tinderbox surrounding this government. We still have universal credit, the terrible saga surrounding that rolling on, if you like. There's numerous other issues in the pipeline. I know for a fact HS2, for example, is going to be hotting up quite significantly next week.
And we've got the ongoing scandal over inappropriate behaviour, sexual abuse, harassment, people having porn on their work computers and all of that sort of stuff. We saw this with, with the major government. I mean, it was essentially smut that did for the major government, which was, the last Conservative government before Blair's Labour government took over in 1997. There's just something different. There's something I'm finding it really hard to kind of put my finger on. There's something different this time. These things are just, we've had the expenses scandal. We've had, all of this stuff over and over again saying to us, a Conservative-led UK government cannot be trusted. Yeah. They just cannot be trusted to even tell, something approximating the truth about what's going on, to even approximately represent the needs of ordinary UK people. They certainly are showing that they can't be trusted to have a Brexit negotiation that involves, seemingly anyone other than David Davis and Theresa May. I mean, the rest of Parliament is in the dark. The UK people are in the dark. We were in the dark when we were asked to vote on this. My personal opinion is that that vote just should never have happened.
Cameron
made an absolutely catastrophic error. I think, the question of should we or shouldn't we be in the EU is an interesting one, and it is an important one. But we didn't know what we were voting for. We didn't know either what not remaining in the EU would look like or what remaining in the EU would look like. So how could we possibly be expected to choose? And I think, right now, the best possible outcome of this, well, there's two outcomes that I would be happy with. One is that it's such a shambles that, the EU Commission turn around and say, no, this is just not going to happen. We are not negotiating with you. Get your act together, or, just go and sit in the corner. Or they actually negotiate something, and then we're asked, do you want to remain with the status quo, or do you want this other something? So we ask this question a lot on the podcast. At this point, given everything that's going on, what do you think is going to happen next?
What do I think is going to happen next? I think we'll probably see a general election before the end of the Brexit process. I can't see that. There's just there's been too many, if you look sort of back since June, there's been too many mutterings about Theresa May's on her last legs. There's only so many legs she still has left. And I cannot see, I mean, it came within a whisper of the government being in serious trouble this week regarding what was happening with the DUP. That was very closely averted a crisis there, if you like, and it is that close, it's that on the knife edge to the Tories' position overall, and this is regardless of Brexit. I mean, generally they're on very shaky ground. I don't think we will get to the end of the Brexit process without a general election, and I think that general election will either trigger that the process has to be stopped because we've had a change of government, or it will trigger a change in direction, regardless of the outcome, whether that be a Labour government or a Conservative one. I think it would trigger a change in direction. I cannot see this process going through to the end. I think it's unfathomable for that to happen, because as well, I mean, bear in mind, as you refer back to earlier, the John Major government, they managed to hang on for 5 years. Now, in some senses, we're in a completely different social time now with the advent of the likes of Twitter and Facebook. Everyone's more connected and everyone should be more aware. But I also think that the speed of events and the speed of which things happen and the backlash that can ensue from the public can happen much more quickly these days. And I think the government's position is so precarious that it could topple at any minute. And I think that's what we'll see. I don't think they're going to last, in my opinion. Tracy, what do you think?
I think that the government will hold on for dear life. I think we'll have to wrestle power from, like, just look at this week, for example. There was a situation where the EU and Ireland within that and the UK were in agreement about how to move forward on the border issue. And the UK government allowed the DUP to scupper that out of self-preservation. Like, there was no, you know, there was no essential need to stop it at that point, because certainly they didn't go, Scotland, what do you think? Do you know what I mean? There was no, they weren't asking regional powers at that point what should happen. Obviously, the DUP is more involved because it's in Northern Ireland, but I just think it's illustrative of how desperately they want to hold on to government. And I think they will, it will take a lot to get it away from them at this point. Unless it just becomes so horrific an experience for them that they run for the hills, you know, that could be another.
I mean, we have the added, this is for another podcast, but I mean, there is chatter sort of building, if you like, about the financial situation the planet is on as well. We have a lot of exploding debts. There's been numerous people predicting that we're due another crash anytime soon, if you like. That's looking a bit of a sticky wicket as well. So,
well, it is. I mean, the system that essentially caused the 2007-2008 crash, you know, it's essentially the sort of, you know, the buying and selling of debt, and particularly a system called credit default swaps. And actually, you know, they went away for, you know, a matter of months essentially, and came back, you know, just with another name. So we're still really, you know, 10 years on, kind of in the same situation. So I think, you know, if you look at the sort of economic analysis, and particularly if you look at economists who you know, kind of break out of the sort of neoliberal tradition, which in the UK is pretty unusual. You've got people like Steve Keen, who look at a much more sort of systems-based, a much more holistic kind of way of looking at economics. And actually, you know, those are the people who are predicting that, you know, yes, we are due another crash. And that could, you know, as you say, that could shake everything up. And certainly if we had another crash, I don't think any government could justify, you know, making a change as enormous as leaving the EU, unless of course they say, well, you know, the economy is in trouble, we don't want anything to do with the Eurozone, let's cut all ties immediately and worry about the consequences later, which I think could be another outcome.
It could be, because there's a sort of big argument among economists about that kind of domino effect, if you like, and the fact that because of globalization, because all economies are now so intertwined, that any crash literally it is like falling dominoes. And of course, the conservative position on that would be, well, you know, we're better off out of this block because we'll be less exposed to that effect, if you like.
But we've not heard that argument yet, because I'm sure, you know, I'm sure...
Oh, I should get my mouth shut.
I'm sure nobody in the current government would like to admit the fact that, you know, that is another way that this could play out.
And also in that scenario, there's been a concerted, repetitive, obsessive effort by this government in the, you know, the current version of the Conservative government to constantly be talking about how neoliberalism is the saviour for everything. Free trade. There's rarely a speech goes by where a government minister doesn't go, we've got to persuade people that free trade is the answer to all of our issues right now. How they can exist in that frame should there be another crash. So regardless of Brexit, whether they can continue and still be relevant is another issue.
As you say, Steve, we could do an entire podcast just on that. Maybe we will.
We could.
Maybe we will. So... thank you, Steve, and thank you, Tracy, for your interjections as well. You know, we've covered a lot of issues today, and if you do nothing else this week, get on a computer, pick up a pen and paper, and write to your MP. It's really, really easy. If you go online, there's a website called They Work For You, and you can find out, if you don't know who your MP is, you can find out there, and you can find out how to contact them. It's really, really easy. And, you know, all of the issues we've talked about today, I think, are relevant for this. You know, our MPs really need to know what we think. There should be no excuse for them getting up and saying, well, you know, my constituents are happy with this, just by virtue of the fact that they've not heard from people. So that's it. That's it for this week. Please make sure you follow us at Canary Pod on Twitter, and use the hashtag CanaryPod to carry on the discussion. We'd be really grateful if you would subscribe and review CanaryPod on iTunes or whichever platform you listen to us on. It helps more people to find us and listen in too. We'll see you next week. Until then, remember, don't get angry, get involved.